Welcome back, everybody. This is Mark Steiner right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We have the pleasure right now of having Dr. Alondra Nelson in studio. She's professor of sociology and dean of social science at Columbia University, where she has served as the director of the Institute for Research on Women, Gender, and Sexuality. She's been one of the leading thinkers in our society on Afrofuturism and more, and we last spoke to her about her book, Body and Soul, The Black Panther Party and the Fight for Medical Discrimination, which was an amazing piece of work. Her latest work is The Social Life of DNA, Race, Reparations, and Reconciliation After the Genome. Just a lightweight subject. And good to have you here, Alondra Nelson. Welcome.
It's always great to be in conversation with you, Mark.
Good to have you here.
Thank you.
And you all can join us here, 410-319-8888. You can write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. Do call in at 410-319-8888. This is such a fascinating subject. I mean, there's a lot here.
Yes.
A lot here. Let me start here. I mean, because part of how you start the book out is talking about you as a young girl at home with your family, a father who was in the Navy, so you had pretty serious bedtimes.
Yes.
As you wrote about.
Yes.
But that when you were a little girl is when Roots came on.
Yes.
And like many people across the country, families were glued to our TV sets, for most of us being the first color TV any of us had. We bought that color television just so we could watch Roots with our family.
Right? In full Technicolor.
Full Technicolor, right?
Yes.
So, and people came from what we had, like 20 people in the room to come over and watch this thing. So what it did to change the nature of this country that many young people don't get, but also how it's connected to this question of genealogy and genetics, I found fascinating.
Yes. So, to set the stage a bit for people who are a little younger than us, I was a young girl then, but I'm no longer a young girl, this was a time not only when we were getting our first color televisions, but we only had three television stations, right?
Exactly.
And so it's so unlike today where you can stream something on Netflix, you and your friends are watching it at different times. I mean, this was really a moment where a nation's eyeballs were glued to their television sets for 8 nights watching Roots take place. So it was a really national event. In the same way, in the mid-20th century, you had people sitting around the radio together, sort of listening to broadcasts and, presidents speaking and the like. And so it's a moment that sort of passed our ability as a nation to sort of watch and be involved in a situation together like this. And, part of what this was, I think, was our attempt to have a national conversation on race that we hadn't had up to this point. And it creates for not only African Americans, but specifically for African Americans, given our history, an expectation that people could trace their roots. So it starts a whole roots craze, phenomenon, fad in the United States that's not unlike the kind of fad or craze that we're having right now with genetic root seeking. You have leading black genealogical organizations come into being at this time. So OGS, the Afro-American Historical and Genealogical Society, starts up the road in D.C. in 1977. Charles Bloxon's book, Black Genealogy, is published in 1977. So it's a whole kind of genealogical moment. And I think that what happens with genetic ancestry testing in the early 2000s, 2002, 2003, is there's a kind of renaissance, not only for African Americans, for the nation, returning to genetic ancestry testing to trace roots to Africa and to think about the past. And to have another conversation about race, actually.
And I think that it also, it's the interesting connection here is again, when you talk about race and racism being at the foundation, the fundamental brickwork of this country, that where we've also always thought of ourselves as this melting pot, at least the European half, or for the European nations all coming here and intermarrying and being part of the melting pot. Black folks, for the most part, were not part of this melting pot. I mean, even Native people in their deep discrimination became part of the melting pot because of all kinds of intermarriage that took place that didn't involve slavery. And everybody wants to claim that my grandmother was a Cherokee.
Wasn't yours? Mine was.
But the difference is that because of the history of this country, that wasn't the case for black folks in America and is not the case.
Right,
for
right.
Black folks
so, you know, a couple of things that are interesting. So, part of the melting pot story is the ability to have a hyphenated identity. So, you're Irish American, you're, you know, Yugoslavian American, you're Italian American. And for African Americans, we've sort of created that hyphen identity, African American. But
that's true,
Africa's
right.
a continent. I mean, there's, you know, there's dozens of countries on the continent of Africa. And so that's not, you know, that's a kind of a racial identity and not an ethnic or a nation state identity that gives you a particular culture or language or foodways and the like. And so part of, I think, what people have been seeking over the last, you know, 40 years with genetic ancestry testing is a link to that more specific kind of identity that's beyond a continental African identity. That's been so much of how we think about that melting pot metaphor, so much how we think about what it is to be an American, what it is to come to this country. And that really, to the extent that that's an important piece of American identity, it's really been denied to black folks. And moreover, the mythology of the melting pot is about people who, you know, come here through their own volition. They want to be here. It's, you know, moving for a better life. And, you know, things just go on an upward trajectory from that point forward. For African Americans, people of African descent, many, you know, were brought against their will. They didn't come. You know, we have a post-65 generation of people of African descent who immigrate. But before that, there are people who were brought here in chains.
Right.
As enslaved persons. And so that's also a different relationship to the great American mythology.
Yeah, this quote here, I think this said a lot to me in terms of the book. And it was from the French sociologist Maurice Halbwachs, who argued, as he wrote in his important work on collective memory, we conjure the accounts of the past we need in order to tackle the issues of the present.
Yes. So one of the big takeaways, so I did over the course of from 2003 to about 2013, I did 10 years of just spending time with genealogists, conventional genealogists, genetic genealogists, and genetic scientists, and just sort of traveling around and looking at how these tests were circulating in the world beyond that kind of reveal moment that's very familiar to all of us from the Skip Gates shows and other genetic genealogy reality shows. And that's the takeaway, really, that, you know, genealogy is important. It's important. It was important in 77. It's important in 2016, but for different reasons. And we're using how we think about the past to say something about the present. So we're using, as I write in the book, the genealogy to say something about reparations, to say something about contemporary racial inequality, to say something about the sort of myth, the lie of colorblind racism in a colorblind society. And people are using genealogical insights to say, you know, how can we be a colorblind society? How can we be a quote-unquote post-racial society
right.
when, as you say, the brick and mortar of this country is racial slavery? And not only is it a kind of macro historical thing, this happened to me and my family. Yeah.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And I think that one of the things that you mentioned a woman here that, you know, many of us forget about, but I think it is key to all this in terms of marrying the world of genetics and social justice and Mary Clay King,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
Claire King, excuse
yes.
me.
Yes.
And the Las Abuelas de Plaza de Mayo.
Yes.
And how this world of genetics, well, let me take a step back before we get to this world of genetics is very confusing to people.
Yes.
And you do a really good job in this book of breaking down some of Kittle's quotes and other things about how this really works and how mm-hmm. we can understand the genome.
Yes.
Because people will say, well, if our genome is 99% alike, no matter who we are on the planet, then how can you tell anything about me and where I'm from by me paying you $250 to do genetic study who I am? So, you know, that's really confusing.
That's the sort of paradox, right?
Right?
I mean, you know, Mary Clare King has there's a quote in the book where she says, you know, the takeaway from the Human Genome Project, which is created and finished in 2003, which is this sort of grand scientific feat in which we decode all of a human genome, and it's a composite genome. So she says that the takeaway is that we're all alike and we're all different. And so that's precisely what you're saying. So we are 99.8 or 9% alike. But what we're able to do technically now is sort of parse that 0.1 or 0.2 difference using high input computing, using new sort of genetic techniques and microbiology and then in laboratories. And that's where people are sort of finding the identity piece and that small difference that makes. I mean, you know, most markers that they use for genetic ancestry testing occur in all groups, but they just occur at different frequencies, right? So that
that's
some groups might have them at 70%. 10%, and some might have them at 20, right? And so that's how you see the, and, you know, with ancestry analysis, that's how you see the 99.9 and the 0.1 sort of play out.
So where those markers placed can say whether or not my ancestors were from Scotland or were Mandinka or whoever they were, is because it's the placement of those, that the
right.
sequencing
yes.
of those genes tell us more
right.
about who we are.
Right, right. Yes, that's right. So there's a spectrum, and then there's also a way in which, you know, we share the same markers, but they'll have different sort of subsegments, right? So which are called haplotypes. So everybody might have, let's say, genetic marker A, but some have A sub 1 and some have A sub 2, right? And that's also a kind of distinction that happens often between groups who intermarry, not because there's something inherently biological about your identity or mine, but we know through human migration and human history and because of religion and all sorts of things, sort of groups happen, you know, marry and mate with one another for these sorts of reasons. So that's the conundrum, but it also offers for us this interesting moment where we can use genetics to sort of say something about society and politics and, you know, the other paradox that exists alongside the 99.9 and the 0.1 is that you, with African-American populations, have the community that's been most subjugated, most traumatized, most surveilled by technology, trying to use it today to have little pockets of freedom and liberation. And that paradox is part of what the book is about.
So, and I'm going to just dive right into this here because I think that starting with what we mentioned before, the Las Abuelas, the Plaza de Mayo,
yes.
And the whole idea of using genetics and genetic research as a liberatory tool, as a political tool, as a social tool. Talk about this incident, then we can dive into
sure,
New
yeah.
York and the Innocence Project and
absolutely
and the Black Burial Site in New York
yes,
and the rest.
Yeah. So the Abuelas case is a fascinating one because it's for so many reasons, but it's one of the first uses of genetic analysis for a humanitarian or for a social justice end. And so, you know, in Argentina, there's a junta state that a lot of activists are disappeared and their children are disappeared, which effectively means they're, you know, murdered. You have their children are taken from parents and placed in other families, we don't know who the families were. So we've lost the bodies of the activists and the parents have been lost, but we have the children, which leaves a kind of genetic tie to the families. So in the 70s, early 80s, a group of women, the abuelas, the grandmothers of these activists who had been disappeared, get together and try to find a way to find their grandchildren, and they turn to Mary Claire King, who is a geneticist here at the University of Washington, who had been always involved in sort of left politics. She had gone to UC Berkeley. She had worked with Ralph Nader. And so her progressive politics take are sort of intertwined with her work as a geneticist. And she helps to develop a technique that the abuelas use to help identify their grandchildren. And so I call the use of genetics to do these kinds of projects of social reconciliation projects. And they happen elsewhere, too. So in South Africa, after the apartheid regime is defeated, the ANC widows use genetic analysis to try to identify the bodies of their husbands, brothers, uncles who had been in the ANC, who were often buried in these sort of mass graves, so they could give them a proper burial and do proper burial rituals and ceremonies with those bodies. And so I try to understand genetic ancestry testing in this transnational, global sort of move to use genetics to do something, to say something about social justice.
So, and I want to jump right here to the project in New York that that was so interesting. I mean, to me, it was like the jumping off point in many ways
for
the world of African Americans, the Black world, and genetics and how they march in together.
Yes,
and I really was fascinating to me because I remember when the African Burial Ground was found and they stopped its construction, which you can describe in New York. But I really was not aware of how Michael Blakey fit in, and nor was I aware of the lawsuit by Deidre Farmer Perelman. I may have heard about it, but it really didn't register as the power it was. And so this is really important.
Yes.
As a kind of a major breaking point in this story.
Yes. So these are also reconciliation projects. So the African Burial Ground, which many people will know about, is discovered in 1991 in Lower Manhattan in New York City. And there are hundreds of remains, probably more, but the excavation of the site is stopped before we know the full extent of it. But we have about 400 remains, and so the question becomes, how do we analyze these remains? You know, on the one hand, you have cultural activists in the Black community saying, you just need to cease and desist, stop everything, let these people be buried. You are disturbing the souls of our ancestors, sort of cut it out. And then you have a group of other Black activists in the community who are working with, for the first time, you have a kind of healthy critical mass of Black and white allied biological anthropologists, archaeologists, geneticists who can have something to say about this, right? Including Michael Blakey, who's at the College of William and Mary.
Quick digression. Yeah. This is also important because people who to read this book, because we are always, we never, ever in our discussions in popular media, understand or include Black scientists, Black geneticists, Black anthropologists. People, I don't think most people realize that this discussion looking at this graveyard from the 1600s, 1700s of Black men and women who were enslaved, many of them African, were being discovered and analyzed by Black scientists.
Yes.
Pulling it up. That's really important.
It's really important. And that wasn't the initial intent,
right,
actually.
Right,
initially,
right.
It was the remains were going to be analyzed by a lab in New York City at Lehman College. And, this coalition of activists and Black scientists got together and said, you know, we're going to take it to Howard University. We're going to go to the Cobb Laboratory and analyze it there. And we're going to use a mode of analysis that thinks seriously about African culture, about how the bodies were buried, about whether or not the bodies were buried with cowrie shells. Were they facing the sun? Were they facing, you know, Mecca, these sorts of things? And that's because you had a group of scientists and social scientists who were really attuned culturally to what was happening, both in the local community in the present and what might have been happening in the past. And so out of this, you get this very interesting, again, paradox in which you have African-American community activists, Black and white progressive scientists saying, we think that we can use genetic analysis to analyze these remains and sort of give us just a general sense, a gloss of where on the African continent these people might have been from. Who are these colonial Africans living in New York City? So this is an extraordinary moment. I mean, for me, when I'm doing this research, because we are people who know about the Tuskegee syphilis study. We are people here sitting in Baltimore who know about the story of Henrietta Lacks. We know about the story of scientific racism. And so for people of African descent to say, we want to use genetics and genetic analysis to do something positive for our communities was a really significant leap. I mean, it's actually, I think, a new moment in Black cultural politics. And so So we end up with this moment in which at the African burial ground, one of the scientists there, who was a graduate student at George Washington, a man named Rick Kittles, comes up with a technique working with others in which he uses he creates a database of contemporary African DNA and they're able to obtain in a few cases DNA from the bodies that were buried in the African burial ground, and they sort of compare them to make what they call macro ethnic affiliation. So these are inferences about where people are from. And so at this time, this is the mid to late 90s, the findings were things like, you know, these people were from the Gold Coast, or they might have been from the interior Africa. They were macro in a sense that they were broad affiliations. But that sort of technique and Kittle's work on the African burial ground becomes developed into the African Ancestry Company, which some of your listeners may know.
And I do want to get to that because he's clearly a key player in your book. So we have to get to him. But the other person involved in this, before we turn to Deidre Farmer Pellman's lawsuit, is Michael Blakey.
Yes.
And another very important scientist.
Yes. A very important scientist, and also, he was the senior scientist. So he was the project director at the African Burial Ground Project. And, for a long time, I remember, so I studied anthropology as an undergraduate, and I remember learning about Dr. Blakey, and often, it would be sort of like the only biological anthropologist who's of African descent that we know. I mean, he was quite a rare bird, and so it was important to have him leading this work. And I think initially on this project, Dr. Blakey thought that, that the genetic analysis could be used along with historical analysis, archaeological analysis, to tell us a little something more about who these people might have been, how they lived, how they died. You know, I mean, I'm not able to get into it as much as one would wish, but you can find the reports of the African burial ground online. And, you know, this analysis, by analyzing the bones, you learn that people carried weight on their heads. You learn that their bones and bodies were overdeveloped in the places where they were carrying weight as laborers, as enslaved laborers. So it's a really tremendous contribution. So Blakey starts out thinking that this could be an interesting and important contribution. But then him and Rick Kittles have a break at the project. And they have a break over the fact that Kittles is going to use this as a for-profit entity as opposed to doing, there was another imagination for how genetic analysis might be used, and that would be to be a kind of free community good that people could use for their work.
I think that's a very important subtext
key.
And piece,
yes.
key to the story.
Key. Yeah.
And then even the little things in this book I really kind of found interesting, like the strontium levels in the teeth of the people who were buried, and they could figure out from there.
Yeah, from radiocarbon dating. Yeah, sort of where people were born.
Were born.
Yes.
That to me was fascinating.
Yeah, that's a sort of key. That's a key tool of archaeology.
And it seems to me, in some ways, when you talk about looking at the genetic studies and black people in America to find out where people might have come from in terms of ancestry, these things are key. I mean,
absolutely.
Understanding from teeth, somebody might have come from the Gambia, or they
yes.
might have come because of the diet they ate.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's pretty amazing. And I think, you know, so today it's become more common for there to be analysis of what we call ancient DNA or ancient remains that really sort of use the analysis of teeth, of dental morphology, using this kind of strontium measure, that combine that with archaeology, that combine that with, you know, oral history, that combine that with geography. The African Burial Ground Project was pioneering and combining all of these things together with genetics. Like, it was always imagined as a multidisciplinary scientific, social scientific project, of which genetics was just a piece, not the answer, not the key to everything, but a piece.
When I read this piece about the African Burial Site, my first thought was, this should be a play. It could be a musical. It could be a straight play. It should be.
Yes, it might. Maybe it is. I'm sure somebody's written one.
So Deirdre Farmer Pellon comes along.
Yeah, so she and Rick Kittles have various encounters. I mean, he's one of his first jobs is in Chicago, and he was a graduate student at George Washington. She was a graduate student at George Washington, so they meet each other there briefly. He did his PhD there. She was doing an MA degree. And then they sort of meet each other again in Chicago. Rick Kittles recalls that they might have been at an Cobra event or some other sort of event. They were sort of in these sort of intersecting circles in Chicago. And Deirdre Farmer Pellman, people may know, was the lead plaintiff in the class action lawsuit for slavery reparations that starts in the courts in 2002. And she basically goes to law school at Brooklyn College in the late 90s and early aughts to learn how she might get the technical skills she needs as a lawyer to try this case. And, you know, this is an incredible thing because this is at the same time that you've got the Harvard Dream Team. You have Charles Ogletree at Harvard, who are working on their restitution study group and are trying to come up with a legal strategy. And these are the kind of best legal minds, you know, in the United States put to this work. And then you have this young black woman who puts herself through law school because she has a strategy, too, and she wants to try to move it forward. So this case is brought to trial. There was a lot of press about it, so people will remember it in 2002. And then it sort of winds in and out of cases, and I think it starts to be in the press less, and I think people don't know exactly what happens in the case. And why the case is important for me is that genetic ancestry testing is introduced as evidence in this case, right? So and by 2003, the court returns the case and says these plaintiffs, there were eight of them, don't have standing. They can't prove in the context of civil law, or civil court law, that they are the injured parties, that they are the people who are the descendants of slaves, of enslaved people, who are owed reparations. And so they go to African Ancestry. Gina Page, who's the president of African Ancestry, says they show up at her office, Deirdre Farmer Pellman, another one, and say, we need tests for the plaintiffs. And they introduce their test results, their genetic ancestry inferences, as evidence of their link to former enslaved Africans, and their test results are give them inferences like the Niger, the Gambia, and the like. And so it goes to the court, and the court kicks it back. I mean, I think, you know, there's a question around evidence and around genetic evidence and how it works in the court. And then there's also the ideological question about, you know, whether under any circumstances a U.S. court is ever going to go along with reparations. So, but the interpretation, by the legal interpretation was that these tests effectively weren't specific enough, right? So they gave you a kind of large macro inference, but they didn't trace you to a specific person in the Gambia in, say, 1650 who was transported to the U.S., who was insured by Lloyd's of London, who, you know, came on shore in South Carolina, maybe was transported by a train owned by CSX to New York, and then was related to Deidre Farmer Paleman. And that was the level of evidence that the court would need to move this case forward.
I think it's a fascinating case, and I was really kind of – I really enjoyed kind of reading that. We're having some tweets and calls come in. Do call us in at 410-319-8888. You see a couple of emails here. We'll read those as we talk with Dr. Alondra Nelson about her book, The Social Life of DNA, Race, Reparations, and Reconciliation After the Genome. We have to take a short break, but stay with us. We'll be right back. And on our way to break, I want to remind you, The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to testing, you can learn more about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's MarylandEducators.org. Or at SteinerShow.org is Maryland State Education Association's banner. Welcome back. It's Mark Steiner, and please join us here, 410-319-8888. We're talking with Dr. Alondra Nelson about her book, The Social Life of DNA, Race, Reparations, and Reconciliation After the Genome. We'll come to that call in just a minute, and also this message from Clarence we're going to read, and one of the things that just came in via the transom here, all that will come up. But I part of this book really has to do is the controversy around around Dr. Kittle. Rick Kittles and AfricanAncestry.com, and what it tells us and what it doesn't tell us.
Yes.
Using all the kind of celebrities that you write about that kind of got him started.
Yes.
So talk a bit about that and what you – A, what it meant for him to do this.
Yes.
And the controversy around it. And we'll stop there.
Okay.
More questions.
So, so, you know, Rick Kittles is – I think he's probably in his late 40s. He's maybe 50. African-American geneticist, and he – So, you know, part of it, part of this, what allows this moment to be possible, this use of genetics for in Black political culture is, as we were saying earlier, you know, a moment where people can see political progressive possibilities for genetics, for good or for not. But part of what makes it possible is Rick Kittles as a figure. So many of the people I spoke to said, you know, I trust him. And Rick Kittles will say when he gives his sort of stump speech or he's giving a research paper, I understand intimately the history, you know, the ways in which scientific research and scientific investigation has been detrimental to Black communities. And I swear to you that I will not and do not do that. Right. So there's something about, you know, a Black geneticist that there's a trust factor there.
Right.
So there's that piece. And I think, you know, Rick also talks about being a genealogist. So when he was in graduate school at GW, he was a member of a local chapter of OGS was, you know, probably by far the youngest member because OGS members tend to be people that are middle-aged like you and I. So, you know, he was also part of the genealogy community and was in part of a community of people who were trying to find out about the histories of their families and their people. So he has a particular sort of role. So the tests, I mean, you know, I'm very clear in the book about using the word inference. And an inference is our best guess. And why are they inferences when you're using genetic ancestry testing? Well, you're using their inferences because we're creating all the various companies that do the testing. So I wrote the book about Rick Kittles and African ancestry, but I was researching for 10 years all of the genetic ancestry testing companies. And what they do is create a reference database, and then you give your sample to them, and then they match it on whatever their sort of algorithm or formula is for saying that there's a match and that this match is this haplotype group or this, you know, ethnic group or this nation state and the like. So we, you know, ideally you would want to have a genetic database that has a sample of everyone who's ever lived. You'd want to sort of sample the globe, but we can't do that. So we use probabilities and we make inferences. What's your best guess? And so in the case of Rick Kittles and the tests that his company do, they do three tests now, but for the most of the last decade, they've done two, which are on mitochondrial, the mitochondrial line, which is the mother's line, mm-hmm. matrilineage, and the Y chromosome line, which is the patrilineage. So if you think about genealogy or genealogy chart as an upside down triangle, and you or me as an individual is at the very tip of the triangle, the matrilineage and the patrilineage are the left and right sides of the triangle, right? So we know that doing this kind of testing, and all of the companies today do matrilineage and patrilineage testing with some smaller and larger sets of markers, but we know that these tests tell us, it was estimated to tell us about 2% of one's total ancestry. So what that means, if we're still thinking about this triangle, is that you're getting the people on the left and right side up that straight line, but you're not maybe getting information about all the people in the middle, right? And that's potentially, depending on how far back you go back, thousands and thousands of ancestors. And moreover, you know, the genetic ancestry testing doesn't account for history necessarily. So, you know, I write about a woman who got a finding from the Genographic Project that says that inferred her to be to have a haplotype group that would have been in Ethiopia plus or minus 150 years ago, plus or minus 50,000 years. So, you know, what was did Ethiopia exist 150,000 years ago? If we think about the you know, the inferences that people get from companies like FamilyTree DNA and African Ancestry that give them a kind of ethnic group in Africa or ethnic group in, you know, a part of Europe or a nation state in Europe. A lot of these places didn't even exist as places when you go far back in time. I mean, the finding that I get using a mitochondrial test is the Bamileke ethnic group from Cameroon. So, you know, we don't have a sort of time scale here, but certainly Cameroon and a lot of these other places, like we had Yorubaland and there was an empire of Benin, but a lot of these countries didn't exist as before colonialism, before the scramble for Africa, but yet the findings are these things. And so there's lots of questions about history, about how people migrate and move around. I mean, so is it the case that, you know, it could be the case that there was, you know, the one person on my matrilineal line, my great-great-great-great-grandmother, that is inferred to have similar genetic markers as the Bamileke of Cameroon today, but that could be the only Cameroonian or Bamileke and all of my ancestry, you know, but there's no way to really know that. So there's other types of tests, autosomal testing that allows you to capture, you know, more of those ancestors in the middle. But even with these sorts of tests, like conventional genealogy, people, genetic root seekers are making choices about which of the sort of lines and markers and things right. are interesting for them to follow. And so that goes back, going back to the Halbach's quote, that's also what it means to say that our understandings of the past and the way we that use the past are about today. So what question is interesting to you about today? Are you interested in finding, trailing a rare B haplotype that goes to the Malagasy people? Are you interested in tracing a more common, Irish, you know, the genotype haplotype that you might find in your family?
A couple of things here. Then a lot of people are calling in when I get these calls.
Okay.
Antoine and Marie were coming to your calls. And I'm going to read this piece from Clarence, but I want to throw this out first, which is some of the ramifications of this research for people. One of the things you talk about in the book are several times are people who have gotten this test
mm-hmm.
and then have connected with people from the African nation from which they believe their ancestors came from.
Yes,
and that is an interesting kind of phenomenon, and what that does. So talk about that, but also in the context of how that affects the question of people's roots as African Americans.
Yes.
As being African Americans.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And the contradictions that might kind of erupt from that.
Yes. So let's just be very explicit. I mean, the real concern here is in people of African descent specifically, but all of us, thinking about our identities as solely genetic. I mean, that's the most kind of anemic, essentialist way of thinking about identity. And we are all so much more than that, although we are made of biological stuff. So there's that piece. On the upside, you know, there are these connections, interesting connections that happen. So one of the things that I've marveled at in the course of doing this research is that people, I think, I know that you've been doing a series of shows on African and African-American connections, right? And that sometimes we don't have the sort of connections or interactions that we should be having. I live in Harlem in New York City. It's true of Harlem as well, right? So what's been marvelous about this work is to see people, you know, one gentleman who I interviewed in Atlanta gets an inference to an ethnic group in Angola and has
right.
a woman.
That's what I was
yes,
about.
And he's
right.
taking a class, and there's a woman, you know, a woman who had been in his class before, like maybe they had spoken, but they didn't have a tremendous connection. He finds this and gets this inference to Angola, and they become fast friends. She invites him to come to a celebration of Angolan independence with her community, and, you know, they become, there's a connection there. My mother, actually, I don't write about this in the book because it's, but my mother, after she was the, in my family, the most excited about the mitochondrial DNA connection to Cameroon. So within about 2 or 3 weeks of getting that result and me telling my parents about it, my mom, lo and behold, finds someone at her church who's from Cameroon. And it's a, she's, you know, and one of the people, the woman in the couple, Anne, is of Bamalake ethnicity. And, you know, this couple was at our home this Thanksgiving. I mean, my mom has been in touch with this woman now for 5 or 6 years. They spend Thanksgiving with our family. They brought a Cameroonian dish, this fantastic roast. It was roast goat with plantain. And we had that with turkey and ham, you know. So that's a really great thing. You know, what we don't want to do is, and I think at this moment in our world and on our planet, things that help us to have better connections are great things, right? But we don't want to understand, and, you know, my mother should not understand my connection, her connection to this woman, Anne, as having some sort of biological, essential something that's more significant than other kinds of connections.
Let me open the phones here. You have headphones there?
Either of those,
yeah, I'm just fine.
Yeah.
And there's your little...
Yep.
410-319-8888. Let's go to the phones here for Dr. Londra Nelson, and we'll go to, is it Antoine? Line one, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Doing? Very well. Welcome.
Yes, I was calling because I actually did my test. I'm going to say maybe about a half a year ago when I went with this company named Tribe Code, and the haplogroup that they put me under was the E1B1A, and... the E1B1A1 was basically saying that I have 4.25% of Bantu, 20.47% of Luya, 8.82% of Mandinka, and then 42.27% of Yoruba, and then all other percentages made up 75.81% of African blood. And they had me underneath for the E1B1A1.
Okay. Yeah. So this company then specializes or claims to specialize in African inferences from different African ethnic groups.
Yes.
So
and, the name of the group was called Tribe Code.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
You know, this interesting, Antoine, just thinking about the conversation I was just having with Mark, you know, we know that Yoruba is an older society and Bantu is a language group here. And
he said Luo, which is east, which is where Kenya is now.
Right. Yes, exactly. So, you know, it's an interesting mix of language groups and ethnic groups. It's an interesting group, a mix of groups that have existed more contemporarily and some farther back in time. What was your reaction to the results? How do you feel about this particular mix?
I actually was shocked and also amazed at the same time because I never knew that, you know, like truth be told, I never knew that they could trace my DNA like that and then find out exactly where I come from by me living here and being born in America, but they was able to trace it all the way back to the different parts of Africa and match it up with it. So I guess that was probably the most amazing part of it by me being born here and I'm able to trace it like that. You know, that was kind of amazing to me.
It is an extraordinary moment for what we can, the claims that we can make with genetic technology. I would say, and I caution people about this, is that you know, the companies have these proprietary databases. They often don't have transparency about the markers that they use or the formulas that they use to create, you know, your tribal mix here that's, 42.5 Bantu or 4.25, 20% Lua and the like. So, you know, I think I would just caution you that we don't, you know, you might want to try another company. You might want to ask them what markers that they used and ask them to send you the sets of markers, you know, anything that you can do to verify and find out more about this.
I mean, okay. All right. No problem. I really appreciate that. And y'all have a blessed day.
You too, Antoine. Thanks so much for calling in. Appreciate it. I mean, one of the things that I think about as Antoine was talking is that with all the kind of the questions we have to raise around genetics and what they can really tell us about who we are and where we come from, the limitations there. You also write about the other aspect of that, which is its liberatory potential, especially in the black community and communities that have been throughout the diaspora, and this whole question of reconciliation and addressing our political past and how it fits into that. I mean, there are two, the Innocence Projects, another thing you mentioned in the book as well. I mean, so the positive ends of this are what they can give us, and we still, and that story is still being told how this is going to unfold.
Yes.
What
yes.
it will mean.
Yes. I think, you know, part of what I'm trying to map in this moment with regards to genetic technology and technology more generally in black communities is that it's a kind of twofold or double-edged moment, right?
And
so, and that we're no longer in a Tuskegee moment. You know, I mean, there are, you know, detrimental things to black people happen in medical experimentation still, but we're no longer exactly in that moment, and there can be these moments of liberation. But even these moments are really complicated, Mark, because the Innocence Project is extraordinary. I mean, what they've done with that, these, you know, my Cardoza colleagues, and how this has sort of spread to law students and people all over the world and has really helped innocent people get out of jail is a tremendous thing. But, you know, we've had to use this technology in the context of a system of mass incarceration that disproportionately affects people of African descent. So the sort of a priori question is sort of what if we didn't have a racist criminal justice system that didn't require us to have the Innocence Project, right? But that said, you know, it's better to have the Innocence Project than not. You know, the interesting thing watching that evolve over the last decade or so has been also the ways that jurisdictions are sort of putting up barriers about, you know, how long, you know, can we still go back and test that information? It's not like the gates have been open to the Innocence Project and anyone who has a claim of innocence with some forensic evidence can have it retested. There's lots of there's pushback against that as well. So, you know, there's lots of complexities that would still have, even in a moment where there's windows or pockets of liberation, have these sorts of technologies be detrimental for but communities of color.
People are very excited about it. I mean, that one little part in the book where Martin Luther King's son and Garvey's great-grandson were brought together.
Yes.
You know,
yeah. So that's the moment. That's the night I have my reveal in Atlanta.
When you were revealed, right.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. I'm at the Leon Sullivan Foundation puts together a global Africa policy forum. And it happens the week after the UN Assembly in 2008 in the United States. And so there are a lot of African delegates, politicians here, and they come to Atlanta as part of this. And as you know, Leon Sullivan during his life was very much engaged in sort of African and African diaspora politics and in some complicated ways. So I'm the opening act, me and two other black women. And the headline act are the reveals of the president of Clark Atlanta University, Martin Luther King III, and the son of Marcus Garvey, Julius Garvey, who's a retired cardiac surgeon who lives on Long Island. And you know, it was a phenomenal night. And I guess, you know, what's so interesting to me about the reveals of King III and Garvey in particular is that, you know, it was a kind of symbolic, a really powerful and symbolic gesture that to my mind was saying genetics and the black liberation tradition, the black civil rights tradition are connected.
Exactly.
That these things have something to say to one another. Yeah. And working through what that might be is part of a lot of the work of the book.
So let me get a couple of calls in here. I promise you that and get our listeners in this. First of all, from Clarence, he writes in, the how is what fascinates me. Would you say DNA is kind of a biological zip file?
Huh. Interesting. You know, it's interesting because DNA, you know, I use the phrase the social life of DNA. And part of what I mean by that is to capture the various ways that we use DNA and what we think DNA means in all different parts of life. You know, it's I think the first time in human history where you have something like this, you know, this biological entity that's supposed to mean something for how we might conserve art, about going to your question, Charles, Clarence, about how we might even hold data. I mean, there's been, because the, you know, part of what the DNA structure is this incredibly efficient sort of data container because of the kind of folds that happen in the double helix shape. And so there's been endeavors actually to even use DNA, something like a zip file, actually. So that's, I think, a very interesting and germane point.
410-319-8888. Let's get back to the phones here. Marie, you're on the air.
Oh, good morning, both.
Good morning, Marie.
Good morning.
I'm going to ask rather a strange question, and I'll give you the reason why. Back in 2014, on the Animal Channel here in Baltimore City, they had a story about mermaids. I don't know if you saw that or not.
I did not, no.
But it's very controversial. And they didn't show this until 1 o'clock in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
It was that controversial. A question, I think, during their show, which has been repeated in 2015, I think, early. Did we come from the ocean first, or were we land animals and went to the ocean? I know this is a weird question.
So, you know, I can't say, Marie, that I know anything about mermaids at all, and I certainly didn't see the show that you saw in 2014. But basic evolutionary theory tells us that, you know, our evolutionary trajectory does come from water in the ocean in part. So not entirely off base, but I'm not sure about the mermaid piece.
410-319-8888. James, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking the call.
Good morning.
I guess about 10 years ago, there was a National Geographic offered a voluntary analysis of your DNA
for, yes,
like a human genome program.
Yes.
Project. So comparing your description of what is happening today, does these two things relate, or is the accuracy different than it was, when they first instituted this project?
Thank you, James. That's a great question.
Interesting question.
So these things are related, but the sort of the mitochondrial and Y chromosome testing that we were talking about earlier is, you know, estimated to be together about 2% of one's genome. The project, like the Genome Project, the Genographic Project, looks at a larger portion of the genome, and it's a kind of testing that gives you a haplotype group. So the gentleman was talking about being sort of E, Antoine, about being E sub 1. These are large sort of haplotype groups, and the E group is known to be most significantly on the African continent, for example. So they're giving you sort of different slices of your DNA ancestry, this will often tell you. So, you know, I mentioned earlier a woman that I write about who got a finding to Ethiopia 150,000 years ago. So they're not often so deep, the sort of haplotype findings, but these are findings that go back often tens of thousands of years. So it's a different kind of information, and it's really a question of what you, as a consumer and as a root seeker, what kind of information you want. I mean, it was interesting that Antoine used a company called TribeCo because he was clearly seeking information about a kind of African mix. What are the inferences one might make about the various kind of African language and ethnic groups that might contribute to who I am? Whereas the Genographic Project, which was in part a research project, would give you kind of a region. It gives you a kind of a regional identity, which may or may not be useful. Western Europe, you know, Northern Africa, the like, and a period back in time that might be, you know, way farther back than the Middle Passage timeline of a few hundred years ago that people might be more interested in, depending on why they go to genetic ancestry testing.
To possibly be refined in the future.
Hmm.
So I'm curious. This is not in the book, but you also have been known as one of our Afrofuturist thinkers.
Yes.
Right? And so it's always seen as being part of science fiction and the rest. But I'm curious how this comes to play with hard sciences and especially what you've been writing about genetics and,
yes,
where your mind goes thinking about Afrofuturism and what these genetics explosion has done to kind of alter our thinking about who we are.
Sure. You know, so I think that, you know, people will, I get asked this question a lot. And for me, the projects that are the, you know, the Afrofuturist listserv and online community that I started in 1998, and the project on the Black Panthers health activism and this genetic ancestry project are of a piece because even though two are, one's about medical science, one's about genetic science, and one's about more science fictional and representations, I guess the bigger question that I'm interested in, or the bigger issue is, you know, how do the communities, what are the ways in which the Black communities, communities of color that have been the literal objects of medical investigation, you know, who have been the sort of laboratory objects, who have been objects of technological surveillance and technological scrutiny, how do those communities find a way to be sort of agents and subjects of science and technology, right? And so, you know, one way to do that is to look at to Sun Ra and LaBelle and the imagination of what the future might look like. How do Black people imagine the future when they're freely sort of making the future for themselves in art and in music is one way of looking at it. Mm-hmm. Another is to look at genetic ancestry testing and sort of think about, I mean, what, one of the things that's fascinating about this, the story in the African ancestry piece is that here you have a story in which African Americans are the early adopters, right? They're the pioneers in 2003. I mean, these in, this industry in the U.S. is only just beginning
really
in 2003 and 2004. And so how do these pioneers, many of them who are well-educated and who know about the sort of detrimental histories of science and medicine for Black communities, find their way to this, to being the pioneers of this testing in 2003 and 2004? So for me, that's about Afrofuturism more generally in the sense that it's about a kind of leap of imagination about what these new, certainly in 2002, 2003, futuristic technologies might hold for Black experience and Black identity.
It, what you just described, though, what I was thinking about as I was thinking about Kittle and the people he gathered around him to do this, these studies, I mean, the very nature of the oppression of Black people in the West, of how Western society is totally defined by it, but that people have been completely separated from their past and apart. I understand that the genetics revolution is a way to connect the dots that were not connected.
Yes, right. Yes, so, I mean, absolutely.
Right. That's
the early. You know, the first some of the. The first news articles about this are in the Los Angeles Times, and the reporter whose name I unfortunately can't remember. There's a series of two or three articles, and at least two of these makes a reference to Star Trek, right? That this is like such, you know, to imagine, you know, we had the Haley moment, and this was sort of paper trails and flying to London and going through the Lloyds of London archives, just very kind of laborious and things that most people might not be able to accomplish. And then you have the possibility of sort of getting rid of all of that labor and almost in a science fictional way offering to people in the mail what their sort of African ancestry might be or their Celtic ancestry or these days even their Neanderthal ancestry.
Right.
And, you know, there is something science fictional about that very much so.
No, I love that. That's an ancient story as well. That I've played with in my head this. The European Neanderthal meets the first immigrants coming from the African continent.
Yes.
That's a story in itself.
Yes.
Well, Alondra Nelson, the social life of DNA, race reparations, and reconciliation after the genome. Thank you so much for coming to the studio. It's really great to see you.
Nice to see you, Mark. It's always great to be here.
Thanks so much.
Thank
glad
you so
you're
much.
In Baltimore. We have to take a short break, but don't go away. When we come back, we have a brand new episode of Soundbites, our weekly series on food, the environment, and our future.